Okay, this is not great, no, but also it's not entirely unexpected from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rusdell. It is Wednesday today, the 18th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You have heard or seen perhaps the headlines from Wall Street today, right? Not great, as I said, to put it mildly. Scary big drops, lots of red. Also, as I also said, not entirely surprising. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has been following the market story for us the past couple of weeks. He is here to explain. Hey,
Kai.
Okay, so in the broadest possible sense here, Sabri, what the what with all this?
Okay, so this is kind of good bad news.
All right.
So I'll just start small. Several retailers have been missing earnings or margins, so they're not making as much money as they thought. Because, you know, remember for a while there, prices were rising, profit margins were growing, and everyone was like, "Oh, those greedy companies."
Right.
So it turns out that finally consumers are showing unwillingness to pay those super high prices. So Walmart CEO said part of the issue is that people are shopping, but they're buying less expensive stuff, cheaper stuff, stuff with lower margins. And Target had, you know, shipping and freight was eating into its margins. So big picture, this means inflation is having consequences, which is super bad news, you know, for companies. But it also means that, you know, prices can't keep rising like they have been. There's resistance to those prices, which, you know, ultimately is what the Federal Reserve wants.
Well, so riff on that for a little bit, right? Because tightening of financial conditions, right, the aura, as it will, the environment of money in this economy, the Fed is literally trying to do that by raising interest rates and running off its balance sheet. So the Fed's getting what it wants, and we should have seen this coming, right?
Well, I mean, kind of. Like, yes, right? I mean, the Fed is not making policy based on the market.
Right.
It's sort of, you know, I was trying to think about this. Like, so if you're frying fish and you hear that sizzle and that crackle and you might get like splattered with oil, like the point of frying the fish was not to have that happen, but something would be wrong if it weren't happening.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's, you know, it doesn't mind that the market is going down. It may expect the market to go down. It might be even good in some ways that the market is going down. It means people, companies are registering the fact that it is going to be harder to take out loans down the road. Companies are going to be worth less, you know, when interest rates are high. And, you know, and also when your stocks go down, you do spend a little less, which is helpful for inflation. But the point is like it means the message is getting through.
Right. Okay, look, if you talk to Fed chairs, past or present, which I have done, humble brag here, twice in the past, you know, 5 days, whatever, they will swear up and down that while they appreciate what the market is doing, they're not making monetary policy because of the market, as you just said. Do you suppose that if the volatility and honestly the slide gets worse, that Chair Powell and the FOMC might change their mind and you know, maybe not stop raising interest rates, but change their guidance or raise 25 basis points instead of half a percentage point, 50 basis points. What do you think?
Yeah, well, there's a real debate about that. You know, people questioning, like, surely the Fed will step in if it gets too bad, right? This it's called, like, the idea of the Fed put.
Right.
But Powell literally just said that even if we get a hard landing, it doesn't matter. We still have to deal with inflation. So, you know, the idea that the Fed would step in is looking less and less realistic, unless like the market crashing was a direct sign of something fundamentally wrong with the economy.
Right. And the economy is fundamentally strong now, as we've talked about a zillion times. And this is not 2 years ago. When the pandemic was coming. Sabri Benishour on the market story for us, also with fish frying recipes, too, as well. Thanks, Sabri. We'll talk to you soon.
Sure.
Wall Street today, you do not have to be a genius to know it will be the Wawas, although, again, I don't get to decide. There was news of housing today from the good people at the Census Bureau, and it was kind of mixed, to be honest. Housing starts, which is just like it sounds, houses that have started to be built, were down a little bit March to April, but they were up year over year. And it's worth a mention here that these housing numbers are notoriously volatile. They get revised not infrequently. But for people who are looking to buy now or soon, there are some signs the housing market may be starting to cool just a tad. A little. Maybe. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on that one.
So there's good news and bad news if you've been wanting to buy a house. The bad news, of course, is that mortgage rates are up, which means
mortgage payments are going to be higher. They're up more than 40% now from what they were last year for the median priced home.
But Daryl Fairweather at Redfin says the maybe sort of good news about rates being up is that demand is starting to fall.
We are seeing more homes having price drops. We've also noticed a drop in competition for 2 months now.
Now, to be clear, the market is still nuts. Redfin says there are still bidding wars for more than half of homes, and prices are still at record highs and rising. But they're not rising quite as fast as they have been.
People should not anticipate another double-digit price appreciation. Those days are over. So we may return to more normal price appreciation of 4%, 5% a year.
Lawrence Yoon at the National Association of Realtors says the experience of buying a home is also starting to return to normal.
Rather than facing 15 or 20 other buyers for the same property, now maybe people can take more leisure pace. View 5 homes after contemplating over the weekend, make an offer.
We're really approaching this inflection point where we're going to start to see the market shifting a little bit.
Nicole Bichot at Zillow says another sign of that is that inventory is starting to pick up.
That will likely, you know, continue throughout much of the next year or two as we have construction starts and permits up, as we have more existing homeowners listing their homes for sale on the market.
But Bichot says it's still going to be a while before inventory and prices really level out. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
I appreciate that perhaps not all of you are as attuned to every detail coming out of the Federal Reserve as, say, I am, and that's fine, I get it. But knowing where the Fed has been can be really helpful in understanding where the Fed, and thus monetary policy, and thus the future of this economy, is going. That's the gist of a new book by former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke.
I used to joke that one of the advantages of being an ex-chairman is I could read the newspaper and say, gee, that looks like a serious problem. I hope somebody does something about that. So I don't have the responsibility, which is obviously a relief.
Especially one imagines on days like today, right? We played part one of my chat with Dr. Bernanke yesterday. Part two coming at you now.
You mentioned that you're relieved not to have the responsibility. And I asked Chair Powell this the other day. Something about whether he was frustrated that he can't fine-tune this economy, that the Fed's instruments are blunt tools. In retrospect, right, looking back at your time during the financial crisis, mm-hmm. What was your frustration level?
Well, it was very frustrating that we were unable to get the recovery from the Great Recession to be more rapid than it was. It took, I think, you know, in retrospect, a very long time. And I think there were a number of reasons for that, putting aside, you know, mistakes that the Fed made. One was the zero bound on interest rates, the fact that once interest rates were at zero, and we cut them to zero in 2008, and they stayed there for years, that our tools were much more uncertain and limited. The other thing was that tremendous difference between the way the Congress has responded to this crisis and the way they responded to the financial crisis. In dollar terms, if you put together the Trump programs and the Biden programs, fiscal spending to respond to the pandemic has been something like 5 or 6 times bigger than the whole fiscal response that Barack Obama signed in I think, February of 2009. So as we were looking at the recovery, the government, the federal government, was choosing austerity, raising taxes, cutting spending, and it was a bad moment. And I said so at the time. Right. So that was frustrating as well.
Do you think, sorry, just to riff off the pandemic relief that has been coming. Do you think all of that fiscal relief contributed in some way to the inflation we're seeing today?
Well, it certainly did. That doesn't mean it was the wrong policy. The policy was intended primarily as relief, the same way that whenever there's a hurricane, Congress quickly passes a bill to send money to the affected area. But I think it's also true that from a demand-side Keynesian perspective, that all of this money, the $5 trillion or whatever it was, supported very strong spending, which might not have been inflationary in a more normal world. But on top of that, we had a pandemic, which was constraining the ability of the economy to supply the goods and services that people wanted. And so with strong demand and limited supply, you know, Econ 101 tells you that prices are going to go up.
One of the ways that you and Chair Yellen and now Chair Powell have changed the Fed is in your communication strategy. And Chair Powell has been explicit about this, right? I mean, you saw his last meeting. He said, I want to talk directly to the American people. How critical do you think it is that the Fed explain itself to the American public, most of which on a Fed day when, you know, the statement comes out are like, what?
I think it's very important. As an academic, before I came to Washington, I wrote a lot about inflation targets and other methods of trying to provide accountability and explanation. And originally, I was particularly interested in making sure the markets understood what the Fed was doing. But as I led the Fed, and particularly as we went through this very difficult period of the financial crisis, it became extremely clear to me that it was important not just to talk to the bond market, but to talk to the broader American public. The reason for that is that it became obvious during that period that the Federal Reserve was an institution that wielded very great power. It was led by people who had been appointed and confirmed but were not elected. And so the legitimacy of the Fed depended, I thought, on getting the American people to understand what we were doing, why we were doing it, and why it was in the interest of the broader public. I mean, one, you know, I instituted the press conference, but I think I do want to say that Jay Powell has taken it another level, and I do think that's one of the most important contributions that he's made to the Fed.
Back to the book for a second. You say about 21st century monetary policy, which is the title of this book, it's been defined by remarkable innovation and change. That is not a phrase that comes to mind when you're thinking about the Fed, which is 100-something years old. Give me some for instances.
Oh, well, let's think about monetary policy, for example. Compare today to just 2000, the beginning of the 21st century. At 2000, we never heard of quantitative easing. We never heard of elaborate structured forward guidance that is talking about where rates are going to go in the future. We didn't have press conferences. And then on the financial stability side, which is equally important, think about what Powell did in March of 2020 during that financial crisis to lend money as a lender of last resort, not just to banks, but to all financial institutions. Those were all things that even Alan Greenspan would have said, oh my gosh, this is a really big change in how the Fed operates.
I'm going to guess by your tone here, you approve of the steps Chair Powell took at the beginning of the pandemic.
I think the March 2020 response to that financial crisis was extremely well done. It built on what we did in 2008, but it was very quickly administered, and he added a variety of other tools in addressing that problem. So I think, yes, that was a very successful episode. The main thing to say about it, though, is that it showed also that financial regulatory reform is not complete. You know, it's not something we want to happen, that the Fed every 10 years has to come in and massively intervene. Right. So in that respect, it was a wake-up call. But in terms of the Fed's response, I think it was quite constructive. The CBO, for example, said that in 2020, they expected GDP growth to be minus 6%. Yeah. It ended up being minus 2.5%. And the difference was largely the Fed's actions.
So let me ask you then, just as a way to wrap it up, you know, you talk about how blunt the Fed's instruments are. Powell talks about it all the time. I'm sure we can find Chair Yellen saying it. But you've just recited a bunch of tools mm-hmm. the Fed kind of created and did in a time of crisis. Is it unreasonable for the public to expect that y'all being smart economists can figure out a way to more acutely fix things like inflation other than just, oh my goodness, all we've got is the federal funds rate and the balance sheet and forward guidance?
Well, the Fed can be creative, but it has to stay within its legal powers and within the remit that Congress has given it. So it can't do much, frankly, and unfortunately, about, say, big increases in oil prices globally or big increases in food prices. It can't fix supply chains or eliminate COVID. The Fed has got powerful tools in one area, which is that it can cool demand, which in turn will take some of the pressure off inflation. And as a result, how much inflation comes down over the next year or two is going to depend partly on the Fed's policies and how aggressive they are. It's also going to depend on a bunch of things that the Fed and the government in general just don't really control, like oil prices and like supply chains.
Do you miss it at all, being in the mix?
Well, I talk to people in the government periodically just to be a sounding board. And
Do you talk to Chair Powell?
I do occasionally. I think maybe it's just a courtesy on his part, but I have great confidence. I had great confidence in Janet Yellen, who was my vice chair and who I've known all my professional career. I know Jay Powell quite well. He was on my board. He and another governor used to come down to my office on Saturday mornings, and we'd just talk about monetary policy because as a lawyer, he was trying to really educate himself at that time. So I think he's done a really good job of bringing himself up to speed in monetary policy, but he also has, you know, some of the lawyerly skills of being able to argue and explain and communicate, which I think he's used very well.
Dr. Bernanke, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm just going to say Fed governors need to get out more monetary policy on a Saturday morning. Come on. Anyway, coming up.
The only person that cleans the bathrooms at Norma G's is me.
Yeah, I feel that. First, though, let's do the numbers. Okay, so here you go. The Dow Industrial is down 1,164 points, 3.5%, 31,490. The NASDAQ sank 566 points, about 4.7%, finished at 11,418. The S&P 500 tanked 165 points, 4%, 39.23. Sabri was talking about this a little bit. Big retailers loom large on Wall Street today. Higher costs and inventory troubles are hitting Target, even though the Minneapolis-based retailer beat expectations on sales and revenue, missed on quarterly profit, though, because of those higher costs. Shares down almost 25%. Think about that. Similar story yesterday from Walmart. Today, shares of the little retailer from Bentonville, Arkansas that could retreated about 6.8%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.88%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Corporate governance is where we go now, and a ruling by a state judge out here in California last week that a law requiring publicly traded companies to include women on their boards of directors is unconstitutional. A similar California law requiring ethnic and racial diversity on boards was likewise struck down last month. So Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more now on what that might mean for the future of corporate diversity.
In the latest case, the judge ruled that establishing quotas for women on boards is, ironically, in conflict with anti-discrimination law, says Professor David Levine at UC Hastings College of Law.
Never you mind that the reason to do this is that these boards have been dominated by white men forever and ever, but nevertheless, it's seen as it's not putting people on an equal footing.
The California law had been an important impetus to address board diversity, and its reversal could be a setback, says Megan Wang, with The Board List, an organization that helps find diverse directors.
Despite having all of this education and data that already suggests better business outcomes for organizations, there's still hesitancy.
Since the law took effect in 2019, the share of women on boards at companies in the Russell 3000 climbed from 17 to 32% in California, according to the nonprofit 50/50 Women on Boards. But it's not just law that is driving progress on this issue, says Lyndon Taylor with executive search firm Hedrick & Struggles, which tracks the board composition of Fortune 500 companies.
It's hard to go back. And as you make progress, right, the progress may slow, but things will still move forward.
He expects gender parity on boards within the next 5 years, though racial and ethnic representation are still far behind. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Retail sales for April were out this week, and while the headline number was all right, up 0.9%, inflation means that spending might not be as good as it sounds. That said, though, some categories came out ahead. Food service and drinking places, restaurants basically, saw a 2% bump March to April, which got us thinking we should check back in with Lester Gouvia. He runs Norma G's in Detroit.
Currently, business is a bit of a roller coaster. We're starting to see a little bit of a pickup on the weekends. But during the week, we do have some good days. We do still have some bad days. And that's just something that we can't manage. You just deal with it day to day. I actually opened the restaurant August 21st of 2018. Staffing, you know, was a little easier at the beginning. But when COVID hit, you know, people vacated the industry in droves. And staffing is really one of the biggest issues because I do wear a lot of different hats to maintain the business. I'm pretty much the owner manager. I'm also the chef. I also do the shop. I do busing.
I've been bartending.
I have done serving.
I've actually done hosting.
And I clean up. The only person that cleans the bathrooms at Norma G's is me. And I have staff members that really help me and reach out. But at the end of the day, you know, if something isn't done, I have to do it. The pandemic never really went away completely from a supply perspective. There's a certain type of chipotle peppers and an adobo sauce that you want to use. And it's critical to one of our sauces, which is really popular at the restaurant. We serve it with our certain sandwiches and wings and things like that. And I did try a different brand. And it wasn't good. And it was just panic mode. How do I find it? So because the particular store that I usually deal with didn't have it in bulk or in, you know, consistently, I had to pay extra money for it. You know, I think it was worth it because, again, we kept the consistency. At this point in time, you know, I worry about next week. Let me be honest with you. I lose sleep over next week. But all I know is I'll get up today, which I did. I do everything I possibly can. We're going to open the doors today, this afternoon, and we hope we have business. You know, we have a good day today, so tomorrow we're going to be able to come in and do this again. People will be able to get paid tomorrow, and we'll give it another shot.
Lester Gouvia there, keeping things going at Norma G's in Detroit. This final note on the way out today, in which legislative relief for the baby formula shortage might be in the offing. You've heard the statistics, right? 40-something percent of the usually available formula supply isn't. So Utah Senator Mike Lee is working on a new bill to untangle some of the red tape that surrounds the formula industry. It is called the Formula Act. And you know how Congress is fond of those cute acronym-ready names for laws? Yeah, well, here you go. The Formula Act. Fixing our regulatory mayhem, upsetting little Americans. All right, we're done, but here is your moment of economic context. You have heard, I'm sure, that the U.S. Soccer Federation has reached a landmark pay equity deal with the men's and women's national teams. Here, though, is a modest proposal. Pay the women more. I mean, they're better, right? They won it all four times. All right, we're going. Our media production team is Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Risnell. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.